out that Peter could have done more to help her during her bout with hepatitis. "You just went on like nothing unusual was happening," she says. "When I suggested you do some chores, you were nasty and irritable. I don't know why I should put up with that."
"Put up with?" exclaims Peter. "Oh, you don't put up with anything as far as I can see. You make sure I suffer for every little error. Of course, it doesn't count that I was working like mad on a big project. I am just one big disappointment to you. You make that perfectly clear. You weren't so sick when you turned around and gave me a lecture on the proper care of bathrooms."
He moves his chair as if he's about to leave. Claire throws back her head and yells with frustration.
"Little errors! Like the fact that you then frosted me out, wouldn't talk to me for 2 days? Is that what you mean? A creep is what you are."
Peter, his face turned to the wall, comments dryly.
"Yeah, well, this creep doesn't feel like talking to the taskmaster."
Expert demolition of love relationship is now in progress. De-escalating disconnection. Now let's replay this little drama and see how they can create a new kind of dance. Here are the steps that can set them on the path to greater harmony. 1. Stopping the game. In their argument, Claire and Peter were totally ensnared in attack and defend. Who is right? Who is wrong? Who is victim? Who is villain? They are antagonists, using the pronouns I and you almost exclusively.
"I am entitled to caring here," Claire belligerently declares. "And if you can't step up and do that, then I can do without you."
The victory is a little hollow, though, since this isn't what she wants. Peter quietly responds,
"Can we stop this? Aren't we both defeated in this spiral?"
He has changed the pronoun to we. Claire sighs. She changes her perspective and her tone.
"Yes," she says thoughtfully. "This is the place we always go to. We get trapped here. We both want to prove our point, so we do that till we end up totally exhausted."
2. Claiming your own moves. Claire complained that Peter tuned her out, that he didn't try to hear her point when things got hot between them. They name their moves together. Claire reflects. "It started with me complaining and getting very angry. And you, what did you do?"
"I got into defending myself, attacking back," he replies.
Claire continues. "And then I lost it and accused more. Really, I was objecting to your withdrawing from me." Peter, calmer now, risks a quip.
"You missed a bit. Then you threatened, remember? The bit about how you could do without me?"
Claire smiles. Together they come up with a short summary of their moves. Claire loses it while Peter plays impervious. Claire gets louder and threatens. Peter sees her as impossible and tries to escape. Peter laughs.
"The impervious rock and the bossy broad. What a conversation. Well, I can see that talking to a rock must be frustrating."
Claire follows his lead and acknowledges that her angry, critical tone probably triggers his defensiveness and contributes to his moving away after this kind of fight. They both agree that it's hard to be honest. 3. Claiming your own feelings. Claire is now able to talk about her own feelings rather than, as she puts it, focusing on Peter and disguising them in a big fat blame. She shares, "There's anger here. Part of me wants to tell you, all right, if I'm so hard to live with, I'll show you. You can't get to me. But I feel pretty shaken up inside. Do you know what I mean?"
Peter murmurs, "Oh, yes, I know the feeling."
Clear admissions like these of the roiling surface emotions of anger and confusion are the beginning of being accessible to your lover. Sometimes it helps to make these admissions by using the language of parts. This seems to help us acknowledge aspects of ourselves that we don't feel great about, and also helps us express ambiguous feelings. Peter might say,
"Yeah, part of me is numb. It's my automatic response when we get stuck like this. But I guess part of me is shaken up, too."
4. Owning how you shape your partner's feelings. We need to recognize how our usual ways of dealing with our emotions pull our partner off balance and turn on deeper attachment fears. If we're connected, my feelings naturally will affect yours. But seeing the impact we have on our loved ones can be very difficult in the moment when we're caught up in our own emotions, especially if fear is narrowing the lens. In the fight, things happen so fast, and Claire is so upset that she really does not see how her critical tone and the phrase, put up with, hit Peter on a raw spot and trigger his defensiveness. In fact, she states that his behavior is all just about his personal flaws. He is a creep. In the moment, Peter does not see how his statement about not wanting to talk to the taskmaster leads Claire to escalate into threats about how she can do without him. To really take control of demon dialogues and soothe raw spots, both partners have to own how they pull the other into negative spirals and actively create their own distress. Now Peter can do it. He says, "In these fights, I defend and then stop talking. That's when my shutting down gets you all freaked out, isn't it? You start to feel like I'm not here with you. I do shut down. I don't know what else to do. I just want to stop hearing about how you're so angry with me." 5. Asking about your partner's deeper emotions. During the fight and the period of alienation that usually follows the fight, Peter and Claire are way too busy to tune in to each other's deeper emotions and recognize that they're touching on each other's raw spots. But when they can look at the big picture and slow down a little, they can begin to be curious about the other's softer, underlying emotions rather than just listening to their own hurts and fears and assuming the worst about their lover. Now Peter turns to his wife and says, "I get into thinking that you're just out to put me down. But in these situations, you're not just mad, are you? Under all that noise and raging, you're hurting, aren't you? I get that now. I know your sensitive spot is about being left and abandoned. I don't want you to hurt. I guess I used to just see you as the righteous principal, busy proving how useless I was as a spouse." When Claire asks Peter about the softer feelings that came up for him in this fight, he's able to look inside and pinpoint how the phrase, put up with, ignited all his fears of failure. And Claire, remembering their raw spot conversations, adds, "So it's like whatever you do, I'm going to be disappointed. And that feels so bad you just want to give up and run." Peter agrees. Of course, it really helps here if partners have been able to be very open about their raw spots in previous conversations. But assuming you have a big impact on your partner and being actively curious about his or her vulnerabilities helps too. 6. Sharing your own deeper, softer emotions. Although voicing your deepest emotions, sometimes sadness and shame, but most often attachment fears, may be the most difficult step for you, it is also the most rewarding. It lets your partner see what's really at stake with you when you argue. So often we miss the attachment needs and fears that lie hidden in recurring battles about everyday issues. Unpacking moments of disconnection like this helps Claire explore her own feelings and risk sharing them with Peter. Claire takes a deep breath and says to Peter, "I am hurting, but it's hard to tell you that. I have this sense of dread. I can feel it like a lump in my throat. If I stopped coming to you, trying to get your attention, you might just watch us drift off into more and more separateness. You might just watch our relationship fade out, go off the screen. And that is scary." Peter listens and nods. He tells her, "It helps me when you risk telling me that. I feel like I know you in a different way when you say things like that. Then you're more like me somehow. It's easier to feel close. And it makes me want to reassure you. I may zone out sometimes, but I wouldn't let you drift away from me." 7. standing together. Taking the above steps forges a renewed and true partnership between lovers. Now a couple has a common ground and common cause. They no longer see each other as adversaries, but as allies. They can take control of escalating negative conversations that feed their insecurities and face those insecurities together. Peter tells his wife, "I like it when we can stop and turn down the volume. I like it when we both agree that this conversation is too hard, that it's out of hand and scaring both of us. It feels very powerful for us to agree that we're not going to just get stuck the way we usually do. Even if we're not quite sure where we go next, this is a lot better. We don't have to get caught in that stuck place all the time." All this doesn't mean that Peter and Claire feel really tuned into and connected with each other in a secure bond, but it does mean that they know how to stop a rift before it widens into an unbridgeable abyss. They're aware of two crucial elements of de-escalation. First, that how a partner responds at a key moment of conflict and disconnection can be deeply painful and threatening to the other. And second, that a partner's negative reactions can be desperate attempts to deal with attachment fears. Couples won't always be able to apply this knowledge and the specific steps of de-escalation every time they disconnect. It takes practice, going over an unsettling past encounter again and again until it makes coherent sense, and unlike the original event, can draw a possible supportive response from the other partner. Once couples have mastered this, they can begin to integrate these steps into the everyday rhythm of their relationship. When they argue or feel distanced from each other, they can take a step back and ask, "What's happening here?" Even with practice, couples won't always be able to do this. The heat may be too high at certain times. Normally, when my husband misses my signaling for connection, I can step back and reflect on our interaction. I'm still balanced and can choose how to respond. But sometimes I become so raw and vulnerable that the universe instantly narrows down into what feels like a life and death struggle. I react harshly to create some sense of control to limit my helplessness. All my husband sees is my hostility. When I'm calmer, I search him out.
"Can we just go back and do that again?" I ask.
Then we press the mental rewind button and replay the incident. By doing this sort of thing over and over, couples develop a fine sense of when they're stepping onto faulty territory. They feel the ground shaking sooner, and they're able to escape it faster. They develop confidence in their ability to take charge of moments of disconnection and so shape their most precious relationship. It will take a while, though, before most couples develop the abbreviated, almost shorthand, de-escalation language of Auntie Doris and Uncle Sid. Recognizing your impact on your partner. Carrie and Sal provide a detailed example of the ins and outs of the de-escalation process. An upwardly mobile, cool-looking couple who have been married for 20 years, they agree only on that the last four have been hell. They're continually getting into a negative spiral over the fact that Carrie, busy with a new career after years of being a stay-at-home mom, is coming to bed much later than Sal. They've tried negotiating about this, but deals get made and broken. They've been sniping at each other for about 10 minutes in my office. I ask if this sniping is the usual way they relate to each other. Carrie, a tall, elegant woman dressed all in red, including her Italian leather briefcase, told me incisively, "No, usually I just stay real calm. I prefer politeness, and I go off into my head when he does his aggressive thing. But just recently, I've felt more and more cornered, so I just come out swinging to get him to back off for a while." I suggest that the mutual attack cycle I was seeing was then maybe a minor deviation from a pattern of Carrie holding back emotionally and Sal trying to get some sense of control and engage his wife more. They agree. Sal, an articulate corporate lawyer with a touch of gray at his temples, launches into a diatribe about how deprived he is in this marriage. He's offered no affection, attention, or sex. He's not listened to. He's mad, and he's entitled to be mad. Carrie raises her eyes to heaven, crosses her legs, and begins to wave her red high-heel-clad foot up and down. I point out how the pattern is occurring right here. He's getting mad and demanding attention. She's giving, "You can't get to me," signals. Carrie breaks the tension here, openly laughing as she recognizes her own strategy. Sal then offers a few insights into how Carrie's upbringing has damaged her ability to be empathetic and some advice about how she can address that. Carrie, of course, hears only that she is the problem and must work to fix her deficiencies. The tension returns. We talk a little about attachment and love and how our primal programming dictates that when Sal feels disconnected, he will aggressively reach for Carrie, and she, seeing only his anger, will defensively withdraw to try to calm herself and the relationship. This basic, "it's not your inadequacies, it's how we are wired" message seems to help a lot. This couple's pattern of "you will listen, you can't make me" has been in place throughout their marriage, but became more powerful and toxic once Carrie started her successful career as a real estate broker. Each began to fit their fights, rifts, and everyday hurts into the pattern. In an intellectual sense, they understand that this pattern now runs their relationship and that they both end up being, as Sal puts it, victims of the emotional spin cycle. But it's clear that Carrie sees Sal through a narrow prism of distrust. She does not really understand the impact her distancing has on him in the here and now, and how it pulls him into their cycle. She doesn't truly see how she unwittingly shapes his response to her. At one point, she turns to him and asks sharply, "So why is it that you get so pushy then?" "Okay, so there's this wired-in need for contact, and I can be kind of cool. That's my style. But I have been a pretty good wife to you, don't you think so?" Sal nods solemnly, staring at the floor. "But like this morning, you just launched into this thing about how busy I am, how I didn't come to bed till late last night. This is a real issue with us. It comes up all the time. If I don't go to bed with you or come later than you want, you go ballistic. There is something I don't get here. It's like nothing matters except what you want in that moment, even if we've had time together during the day." Sal starts into an elaborate set of points about how he's not really so demanding. Carrie is off in some other world before he finishes his first rational sentence. "We need to change the level of dialogue here and get a little more emotional engagement." I ask him if he remembers how he feels, waiting for Carrie to come to bed. He takes a moment and then retorts, "Oh, it's great waiting for your wife all the time, wondering if and when she's going to deign to turn up." At first glance, he looks like just what he is, a man used to being in charge and having people jump to please him. But underneath the reactive anger, I hear the doubt about her turning up to be with him. I ask, "What is happening to you right now as you speak about this? You sound angry, but there's a bitterness here behind the sarcasm. What does it feel like to be waiting for her, feeling that she doesn't care how long you wait or may not come at all?" I have pushed the down elevator button. After a long silence, he answers, "It's bitter," Sal admits. "That's the word. So I turn it into straight anger. But what does it feel like to be waiting?" And suddenly his face crumples. "It's agonizing, that's what it is." He covers his eyes with his hand. "And I can't handle feeling that way." Carrie moves her head back in surprise. She furrows her brow in disbelief. In a soft voice, I ask Sal to help me understand the word agonizing. As he starts to speak, all traces of Sal, the terror of the courtroom, fade away. "It seems to me that I'm always on the edge of Carrie's life," he says. "I don't feel important to her at all. She fits me in the cracks in her busy schedule.
We used to always be close before going to sleep, but now, when she doesn't come to bed for hours, I just end up feeling pushed aside. If I try and talk about it, I just get dismissed. Lying in bed by myself, I go into feeling so unimportant. I don't know what happened here. It wasn't always like this. It feels like I'm all by myself here.
I pick up on the words by myself and pushed aside and his sense of loss. I remember listening to him talk in the first session about his lonely childhood, mostly spent in expensive boarding schools while his diplomat parents traveled the world. I remember him telling me that Carrie is the only person he's ever felt close to or trusted, and that finding her had opened a whole new world for him. As I reflect these thoughts and his own words back to him, I legitimize his pain. Then I ask how it feels right now to talk about these difficult feelings of being pushed aside. He continues,
"It feels sad and kind of hopeless."
I ask, "Is it like some part of you says that you've lost your place with her? You aren't sure how important you are to Carrie anymore?"
"Yes."
Sal's voice is very quiet.
"I don't know what to do, so I get mad and make lots of noise. That's what I did last night."
I comment, "You're trying to get Carrie's attention, but you feel hopeless. It's scary for most of us when we're unsure of our connection, when we can't get the person we love to respond to us."
"I don't want to feel this way,"
Sal adds,
"but you're right. It is scary, and it's sad. Like last night, I lay there in the dark and my mind said, she's busy, she can take her time. And here I am. I feel like some kind of pathetic fool."
As he says this, his eyes fill with tears. And this time, when I look at Carrie, her eyes are wide open. She's leaned forward toward her husband. I ask her how she's reacting to the things her husband is sharing. "I'm really confused here," she says, and turning to Sal, she asks, "Are you serious?" "You are. You get mad at me because you don't feel important to me. You feel alone? I've never, ever seen that in you. I've never imagined." Her voice trails off for a few seconds. "I just see this belligerent man out to get me." We talk about how strange it is for her to hear about how her being less accessible affects him, and that he now lives in a world where he misses her and is scared that he's lost his place with her.
"I really understand that you would see me that way," Sal goes on. "I do try to stay away from these feelings. It's easier to just get angry or sarcastic. So that's what you see."
Carrie looks like she's struggling here. Her husband is not the man she thought he was. I cannot resist pointing out that Sal's anger pushes Carrie away, and as she distances, they both step into a spiral of insecurity and isolation. "I really didn't know you felt that way," says Carrie. "I didn't know that my staying apart, trying to avoid all the angry exchanges... I never knew you were waiting for me and feeling so hurt. I didn't know how painful that was for you, that it mattered to you so much that I come to bed. When we fight, it sounds like it's all about how you want more sex." Now her face and her voice have softened. Then, in an amazed whisper, she says, "I didn't know I mattered that much to you. I just thought you wanted to be in control." I asked her if she could see that her distancing to avoid Sal's anger switched on his attachment fears, touched him on a raw spot, and triggered his anger, pulling him into the spiral of distress. "Yes, I see that," she acknowledges. "I guess that's why he can't just decide to stop being so angry, even when we've discussed it and how I don't like it. I guess I'm hearing how my staying distant and busy sparks all those feelings in him. And then his anger is too much for me and I run away more. And then we are stuck." She turns to Sal. "But I never knew you were waiting alone in the dark for me. I never got that I had that impact on you. I just didn't see that, that you might be feeling alone in the dark.
Carrie and Sal are really beginning to see the power they have over each other on an emotional attachment level. They can begin to grasp how each of them triggers the other's fears and keeps their protest polka going. He protests her distance. She protests his aggressive ways of trying to connect with her. Sal and Carrie start to see in a concrete way how they hook each other into their negative pattern. Recognizing how fear drives your partner. In a different session, Carrie and Sal are revisiting another rocky moment. This time, when Carrie had asked Sal for his opinion about the dress she was planning on wearing to a family wedding where she felt very much like an outsider. Carrie had been angling for support from him, but he missed the cue. Instead, he became vaguely critical, implying that she already knew he disliked this dress and that his opinion or what he found attractive didn't matter anyway. This had rapidly escalated into an argument about the quality of their sex life. Enter the old dance of Carrie shutting down and avoiding a more and more irate Sal. But this time, knowing their cycle, they replayed the argument and picked up insights about how their mutual attachment fears keep them desperate and distant.
"Well, you did ask me about your dress," Sal says. "Does it work?" you asked. "I gave my opinion, that's all."
Carrie turns her face to the window. She struggles to keep from crying. When I ask her what's happening, she turns and lunges at Sal.
"Yes, I asked you. And you know it is a big issue for me how I look in that group. I don't feel safe there. You could have just said something supportive, but no, I get snarky comments about how I'm not interested in pleasing you. I asked, didn't I? I wanted support, not a whole bunch of criticism. What the hell do you want from me? I can't do anything right here. This is one of these moments when I just want out of here, like, beam me up, Scotty. And in the end, it's always all about the fact that you want more sex."
She turns her whole body away from him and stares pointedly at the opposite wall.
"You are right," he answers in an intense, clipped voice. "You did ask. But since when did my opinion really make a difference here? You'll wear what you want. What I want is irrelevant. And yes, it doesn't help that you're so cold with me in bed, but that's just part of all this. It's not just that I want more sex."
I invite Sal and Carrie to pause here and press replay. What would a movie camera have seen in the last few minutes? I knew they could do this. I had seen them exit from their cycle this way only the week before. Sal smiles and leans back in his chair. Then he paints a picture of how they get stuck.
"Yeah, okay. Here comes the push-step-back thing again. I guess this isn't really about the dress, is it? And it's not even about sex."
I love that he says this. He understands that they're missing the point, the attachment feelings and needs that drive their drama. He sees the negative spiral as it's happening. Now he needs to take a step out of his critical stance. He turns to Carrie.
"I am getting kind of pushy here, I guess. I think I'm still smarting from last night. If you remember, I suggested that we cuddle a little in the study, but you were tired."
He pauses, looks down.
"That happens a lot."
Sal has just changed the level of the conversation in a powerful way. He turns his attention to his own reality and invites her in. Now I wait to see how Carrie will react. Will she stay distant and unavailable? Will she take this opportunity to smack him with a comment like, "Oh, so you are smarting. Well, listen up, buddy." Or will she respond to his attempt to escape their usual loop of anxious pursuit and injured withdrawal? Carrie takes a deep breath and lets it out. She speaks softly.
"Right. This is about you reaching for me and me being tired. So then you get all hurt and bitter, and now this is all about how I don't really value your opinion and didn't come to snuggle."
She puts the attachment story together, the plot behind the drama of the moment, identifying the emotional issue in their struggle.
She continues, I did want your advice about the dress, but you got stuck in all this anger, is that it? Hey, we've been here 1,000 times before. We have gone over this. Why can't we just stop this?
I can't resist pointing out that they're doing just that right now. They're seeing the bigger pattern rather than narrowing in on and reacting to the other's negative moves. Carrie now takes another step toward creating more safety. She leans toward Sal.
Well, I guess I am still learning about your raw spots. I can see that you might have felt that I was cold last night. I was just so exhausted. I kind of chickened out of trying to explain that to you. I knew you wanted to be close. Maybe I was scared we would get into this stuff. So I just zoned out.
Was it one of those times we've talked about? Sal asks. When you think that nothing but a 2-hour hot lovemaking session will please me? One of those times when you get that feeling of pressure that you just can't meet my demands? This response just amazes me. Once they've slowed down their demon dialogue, the space opens up for curiosity, for reaching for the other's reality. Sal isn't just trying to sort out his own feelings. He's putting himself in her shoes and embracing her feelings. Carrie's obviously touched by this, and I notice that she reaches down and takes off her red high heels, her snippy shoes, as she called them. Those shoes announce to the world that she's strong and to be reckoned with. She moves her chair closer.
Yep, I did feel that pressure, and I guess I did just zone out. But we know now that that kind of moment is really loaded for you, yes? Then you go for me and I withdraw more. That is how it usually goes.
There's a new music in the room. Each partner is looking down at their dance and naming their steps in it. But more than this, they're seeing exactly how they pull each other in. But do they really see the impact and how this cycle traps them both in isolation and fear? I comment, and that is so hard for both of you. You both end up so alone. Yes, says Sal. Then I go into that sad and scary place, I guess. That's kind of what I was trying to say in my angry comments. Why was she asking my opinion like what I say matters to her anyway? Once that feeling comes up, he goes still and silent. That's when you get afraid, unsure of how important you are to Carrie, I point out. And that's the way it is for all of us. That fear is just part of loving. But it's hard to sit with and recognize, easier to just move into mad. Carrie is now totally focused on her husband, speaking in a quiet, matter-of-fact voice.
So that fear just kind of drives you into that dark place?
Yes, Sal answers, and I just flip into trying to deal with it, fix it. I just get mad.
And then, Sal, your anger just turns on Carrie's own fears. I note.
Right, Carrie agrees. That's where I go into my funk about how I cannot ever please this man. I'm just not enough. The silly thing is that I like cuddling on the couch. I like our lovemaking. We both get triggered and get done in by this silly dance. I point out that they've just caught the demon in the dialogue and wrestled it to the ground. They've dealt with their fears in a different way. A way that soothes their anxieties rather than puts them through the roof. But Sal has one more very important thing to say. He seems to have grown bigger in his chair, as if he suddenly finds himself on more solid ground.
We are starting to get a handle on this. If we can see where we get stuck, and if we can do something about these raw places and how they're triggered, why, we might even be able to be...
He pauses and searches for the right words.
Well, more together, even.
He finishes and smiles. Carrie laughs and reaches for his hand. What did we just see Sal and Carrie do here in these last two conversations? They've started to go beyond just doing the steps in their negative dance and to see the pattern it's creating as it occurs and begins to take over their relationship. They are acknowledging their own steps in this dance. They've begun to see how these steps trigger each other into the primal program of attachment needs and fears. They're starting to grasp the incredible impact they have on each other. They're understanding, voicing, and sharing the hurt of rejection and fears of abandonment that drive the dance. All this means that they have the ability to de-escalate conflicts. But more than that, every time they do this, they're creating a platform of safety on which they can stand to manage the deep emotions that are part of love. Now that you see how de-escalation works, it's time for you to make it work for your relationship. Play and practice. 1. With your partner, pick a brief, unsettling, but not really difficult, incident from your relationship, one that happened in the past 2 or 3 weeks, and write down a simple description of what happened as seen by a fly on the wall. Hopefully you can both agree on this description. Now write out in a plain sequence the moves you made in that incident. How did your moves link up with and pull out the moves your partner made? Compare notes and come up with a joint version you can agree on. Keep it simple and descriptive. 2. Add in the feelings you both had and how each of you helped to create this emotional response in your partner. Share your responses and agree on a joint version. Now ask about the deeper, softer feelings that might have been happening there for your partner. Be curious. Being curious gives you valuable information. If your partner has a hard time accessing his or her softer feelings, see if you can guess using your sense of your partner's raw spots as a guide. Confirm or revise with your partner what his or her deeper feelings were. 3. Using the information above, see if you can together describe or write out what you might have said to each other at the end of this incident. If you had been able to stand together and complete it in a way that left you both feeling safe, what would that have been like for you? How would you have felt about each other, your relationship? 4. Try the previous 3 practice questions with a difficult, unresolved incident. If you get stuck, just acknowledge that a certain part of the exercise is hard for you. If your partner finds the exercise hard, ask if there's any way you can help him or her right at this moment. Sometimes a little comfort is all people need to be able to stay with this task. 5. If you knew that you could take moments of conflict or disconnection and diffuse or review them in this way, what impact would this have on your relationship in general? Share this with your partner. With what you've learned in the first 3 conversations, you now have the ability to de-escalate conflicts. This is a great deal. But to really have a strong, loving, healthy relationship, you must be able not just to curtail negative patterns that generate attachment insecurities, to see and accept each other's attachment protests, but also to create powerful, positive conversations that foster being accessible, responsive, and engaged with each other. You'll do just that in the following conversations. Conversation 4. Hold me tight, engaging and connecting. When someone loves you, the way they say your name is different. You just know that your name is safe in their mouth. Billy, age 4, defining love, as reported on the internet. There's one image of love that Hollywood has right. That is the moment when 2 people gaze deeply into each other's eyes, move slowly into each other's arms, and begin dancing together in perfect synchrony. We know instantly that these 2 people matter to each other, that they are connected. These moments on screen almost invariably signal that a couple is in the intoxicating early days of a romance. Rarely are they used to illustrate a more mature stage of love, and that's where Hollywood gets it wrong. For such moments of intense responsiveness and engagement are vital throughout a relationship, Indeed, they are the hallmarks of happy, secure couples. Almost all of us are naturally and spontaneously tuned in to our partners when we're falling in love. We're hyper-aware of each other and exquisitely sensitive to our partner's every action and word, every expression of feelings. But with time, many of us become less attentive, more complacent, and even jaded with our partners. Our emotional antennas get jammed, or maybe our partner's signals get weaker. To build and sustain a secure bond, we need to be able to tune in to our loved one as strongly as we did before. How do we do this? By deliberately creating moments of engagement and connection. In this conversation, you'll take the first step toward doing that, and subsequent conversations will show you how to actively further a sense of closeness, so you'll be able to create your own Hollywood moment at will. The Hold Me Tight conversation builds on the sense of safety you and your partner have started to produce as a result of conversations 1, 2, and 3, which taught you how to halt or contain negative patterns of interacting with your partner, as well as to mark and name at least one of the deeper feelings that come up in negative cycles and moments of disconnection. Effectively seeking connection and responding supportively is hard without a basic platform of safety. In this conversation, you'll learn how to generate positive patterns of reaching for and responding to your loved one. In effect, you'll be learning how to speak the language of attachment. Think of it this way. If conversations 1, 2, and 3 are a little like going for a walk in the park together, then conversation 4 is like dancing the tango. It's a new level of emotional engagement. All of the previous conversations are preparation for this one, and all the upcoming dialogues hinge upon a couple's ability to create this one. Conversation Hold Me Tight is the ultimate bridge spanning the space between two solitudes. Stepping aside from our usual ways of protecting ourselves and acknowledging our deepest needs can be hard, even painful. The reason for taking the risk is simple. If we don't learn to let our partner really see our attachment needs in an open, authentic way, the chances of getting these needs met are minuscule. We have to send the signal loud and clear for our partner to get the message. If we have generally found others to be safe havens and have a secure bond with our lover, then it is easier for us to keep our emotional balance when we feel vulnerable, connect with our deepest feelings, and voice the attachment longing that is always part of us. If we are feeling unsure of our relationship, it's harder to trust our longings and risk being vulnerable. In that situation, some of us try to stay in control of our emotions at all costs, to hide them, and instead demand what we need. Others deny that the emotions and needs even exist, but they are there. As the perceptive but murderous villain of the movie In the Cut murmurs to Meg Ryan, the heroine who avoids closeness with others, "You want it so much it hurts." Conversation 4 has two parts. The first, "What am I most afraid of?" requires further exploring and elaborating on the deeper feelings you tapped into in the previous conversations. In those dialogues, you were taking the elevator down into your emotions. To discover your attachment priorities, you must now go all the way to the ground floor. The second part, "What do I need most from you?" is crucial, the tipping point encounter in EFT. It involves being able to openly and coherently speak your needs in a way that invites your partner into a new dialogue marked by accessibility, responsiveness, and engagement, an ARE conversation. A couple in trouble. Charlie and Kyoko are a young immigrant couple who come from an Asian culture where the husband is very much the head of the household, and emotional expression is frowned upon. Kyoko had been placed on antidepressant medication by her doctor when she became hysterical after being refused entry to a university graduate program. Charlie tried to help her by offering advice, but it consisted largely of telling her how unsuited she was to any of her career choices. Needless to say, that didn't help. This is where they are when they come to see me. Charlie and Kyoko easily identify their demon dialogue. He stays emotionally removed and delivers logical lectures full of shoulds, while she dissolves into angry tirades and teary hopelessness. After a few sessions, they can touch on their raw spots, although it's still hard for them to really explore their sensitivities. Kyoko, small, exotic, and speaking very fast in her lilting English, confides that her childhood was full of rigid rules, that she was shunned by her family until she complied with these rules. I frame it that Kyoko is now allergic to being told how she should be and feels punished when Charlie is distant. She tries to explain to Charlie, "It's like I'm already on the floor feeling small, and you come in to take charge. You tell me, 'Yes, you should feel small. Now do this and do that.' So I fight you. Your advice just puts me down. I get hurt and angry. Then you give me more rules about not being angry, and I'm alone, with no comfort." She allows that her husband is incredible in many ways. He's responsible and conscientious, and she respects him very much. But their fights and his physical and emotional distancing are driving me crazy. I think you call it nuts. I only get more depressed. Charlie, a physics whiz, has had a very hard time taking this in at first. His idea of love has been to protect his wife from her own upset and to guide her in this new North American world. As to his own emotions, he admits at one point that his heart is shattered by Kyoko's angry explosions. But mostly he minimizes his hurt and focuses on his wife's problems. Charlie slowly moves from criticizing Kyoko's reactions. "Kyoko has a psychological problem. She's like the weather." Into discussing his own reactions. "I do protect myself. I can't deal with her unreasonable outbursts. We never spoke like that at home. That kind of talking is foreign to me." And finally, into exploring his own emotions and motives. "I get overwhelmed here, so I give her advice, formulas, to stop her being so angry." Kyoko becomes clearer on how she pushes to get her point across and stop Charlie moving away from her. She acknowledges her hurt at Charlie's censure and goes on to reveal that she feels discarded since Charlie has pulled away from making love or any physical contact. The words "overwhelmed" and "discarded" seem to echo around my office. By the end of the hour, Charlie concludes, "I guess my advice and my logic wind up hurting Kyoko and make her feel small. Trying to push her feelings aside just makes everything worse." Kyoko, in turn, says she now sees how Charlie's detachment and logic are a cover for his discomfort with her upset. They move on to a revisiting a rocky moment conversation. The moment occurred when Charlie had been away visiting a friend, and Kyoko, feeling lonely, had called him. Although he had heard the emotion in her voice, Charlie cut her off, saying he was busy and had to hang up. But when they replay that moment, they're able to hash out what happened. Kyoko discloses how she had been thinking about their relationship problems and had this sudden urge to call to get some reassurance. Charlie explains how, once he heard the emotional intensity in her voice, he had become anxious and had simply run away from the explosion that he feared was coming. Kyoko then concedes that she does indeed get crazy upset when Charlie distances and that she can see how this might confuse and overwhelm him. They both feel good that they can now share how they sometimes lose their way in their marriage and get stuck in complaining about each other. It is now time for Charlie and Kyoko to move into conversation 4 and risk acknowledging their deeper needs. What am I most afraid of? This part of the conversation is aimed at gaining greater emotional clarity. I ask Charlie how Kyoko can help him get the safe, loving feeling they had once experienced back into their relationship.
Well, I wouldn't get anxious and lecture her if she would just quit exploding, he replies.
I then invite him to talk about himself and his feelings. He tells me that he's not sure where to begin. This world of feelings is foreign to him. But he does now see, and he gives me a big smile here, that maybe there is a logic to being able to listen to feelings and share them. He turns to Kyoko and tells her that he does see her as more predictable, as safer, now that he understands that she feels pushed away and punished by his advice-giving. But he's not sure how to really get into his own deeper feelings here. I ask him how he identified his feelings in the previous conversations. Where did he start? He's a very clever man, and he tells me what we therapists often take years to learn. He says,
"Oh, I look first at what blocks me, what makes it hard to focus on feelings. I look at that moment when I stay away from my feelings and go off into my head sorting for formulas."
I agree, and Kyoko helpfully joins in, telling him, "It must be like me learning English. If feelings are a foreign language for you, it's hard to feel comfortable. We try to stay away from what is strange. Strange is scary."
Charlie laughs and replies to his wife, "Yes. I go away from feelings because they are strange. I don't feel in control. It's easier to make up an improvement program for you."
He turns to me and makes a second point. "In our best conversations, it helped to take what you call handles and mull them over." Handles are descriptive images, words, and phrases that open the door into your innermost feelings and vulnerabilities, your emotional reality. Kyoko and I remind Charlie of some of the handles he's used to describe his reactions to Kyoko: a shattered heart, overwhelmed, anxious, freaking, and fleeing. Charlie nods his head but looks doubtful.
"It's hard for me to slow down and stay with those handles," he whispers, "even just to let myself explore. To listen for the cues that spark my feelings and thoughts. I don't know where this will go. I trust thinking more, but maybe it's not enough here."
I nod and ask him what handle holds his attention right now. He says quietly,
"Oh, that is obvious. I go off in my head when I cannot stand the disquietude, the foreboding."
Kyoko and I both lean back a little. "What does disquietude, this big abstract term, have to do with anything?" I wonder aloud. Then Kyoko chimes in. She has learned from previous conversations to unpack big abstract words like this so that they don't hijack the conversation. She leans forward and asks, "Charlie, is it like you stay away from your emotions and from mine because of big anxieties?" Charlie stares at the floor and nods slowly. He sighs.
"I just want to keep everything under control, so I guess there are big anxieties. I do get overwhelmed when Kyoko gets so upset with me, and then I start to feel lost. I don't know what to do."
At this point, I want to go to the root of a partner's fears, so I ask, "And what is the biggest catastrophe that could happen here, Charlie? What are you most afraid of?" But I don't need to ask. Charlie goes there by himself.
"The word shattered keeps coming up in my head," he says. "If I stay and listen to Kyoko's upset, I will be shattered. I will lose control. The explosion will kill us."
Charlie has said a lot here. We need to mine this moment a little. So I try to take it piece by piece and help Charlie expand on it. It's always best to start with identifying the emotion.
I ask, "So, Charlie, the basic emotion I hear in this is fear. Is that right?" He nods solemnly.
"I feel it right here,"
he says, and pats his chest. So I continue. "But what does this fear tell you? What are the terrible ifs here? Maybe if you don't stay totally cool, she will go even more out of control? Maybe you will hear that she wants something that you don't know how to give her? If you stay open and hear that your wife hurts, then you haven't been the perfect husband you should be. Then you might lose her completely?" Charlie nods vigorously.
"Yes, all of it, all of it.
I have tried so hard, but what I know how to do doesn't work. The more I try to get her to be reasonable, the worse it gets, so I feel helpless, really helpless. I am good at everything I do. I follow the rules, but now..." He spreads his hands in a gesture of defeat. "Don't we all want the one or two infallible rules for how to love and be loved? But love is improvisation." And Charlie cuts off his best guide, his and his lady's emotions. I ask him, "Listening now to this sense of fear and helplessness, what is the main threat, the most frightening message? Can you tell, Kyoko?" He sits bolt upright and shouts out, "I don't know how to do this. I can't figure it out." He turns more toward Kyoko and continues, "I don't know how to deal with it when you're not happy with me, and you can explode any time. I never feel sure of myself with you, and I need that. I feel very sad. We came across the world together. If I don't have you..." He weeps. Kyoko weeps with him. What has happened here? Charlie has moved into and laid out the deeper emotions that speak to his need for a safe emotional connection with his wife. He is shaping a coherent attachment message out of his emotional turmoil. As I look at him, he's actually smiling at me. He does not seem helpless or overwhelmed. I ask him, "How are you doing, Charlie, having said all this?"
"So strange," he replies. "It feels good now to be able to say these things. I did not shatter. Kyoko is still here, and I feel stronger somehow."
When we examine and make sense, or as I put it, order and distill our experience, no matter how painful the process, there is a sense of relief and empowerment. This is a new, more accessible Charlie. How Kyoko responds at this point is critical. Too often in unhappy relationships, when one person takes a risk and opens up, the other partner doesn't see or is afraid to trust the revelation. I've heard partners dismiss their lover's new steps toward them with everything from, "That's ridiculous," to some version of, "So let's see you prove it." Then they spin back into their demon dialogue. The truth is, no one takes the risk of being rebuffed by disclosing, like Charlie has, unless the other person really matters. And sometimes disclosing partners have to be willing to hang in there and keep repeating their message until their loved one gets used to seeing them in a new way. Couples stuck in a demon dialogue can also get moving again by doubling back through conversations 1, 2, and 3. Happily for Charlie and Kyoko, she responds in a supportive way to his overture. "I understand much more now how you go into that cold, rational place and end up giving the instructions," she says. "I never knew I mattered enough to you to hurt you that much. I respect you for doing this kind of sharing. It makes me feel closer to you." Charlie simply grins at her and gives his chair a twirl or two. The ability to attend to our partner's deeper disclosures is the beginning of mutual responsiveness and engagement. The word attend comes from the Latin attendere, which means to reach toward. Kyoko has reached toward Charlie. Now it's Kyoko's turn to unpack her emotions and see if Charlie can attend to her. She goes back to the rocky moment and tells Charlie, When you came home, I told you I was upset, and you said, now don't get all crazy on me, that if my outbursts didn't stop, you might need to leave. This was the bottom for me. I cannot always be calm and logical. Charlie.